Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Gary McGuffin, Canadian explorer, photojournalist, speaker, documentarian, and conservationist. Nature has been his most influential teacher throughout his life and career. The seasons draw him to various natural locations to capture the elements in his magnificent photographic compositions. As a young man wondering how he might make a living in the outdoors, Gary attended Seneca College in the two-year outdoor recreation technology program, where he met his wife, Joni, and together they began a long journey traveling the many Canadian natural trails that have led to amazing discoveries and experiences, bridging past and present. Together, they have written and illustrated numerous publications, presentations, documentaries, such as the award-winning production of Painted Land, In Search of the Group of Seven, collaborating with art historian Michael Birch and the film team. This documentary is the result of 7 years of research and traveling across Northern Ontario to discover the exact locations the Group of Seven Canadian artists brought to life the powerful Canadian landscapes that inspired their brilliant sketches and paintings. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, Susan. I'm out of breath just listening to that.
You're a very accomplished photographer, explorer, and have won numerous awards and recognition for your work with your documentary, Painted Land, In Search of the Group of Seven. Can you give us an introduction to the documentary and what led you to become involved?
Well, that's a good question, Susan. That's a long story, but I will start at the beginning. It started off about, 15 years ago, and Joni and I were working on a project called Visions of the Boreal Forest with the Smithsonian Institute, and we were traveling with five other artists across the Boreal Forest from Ungava Bay, the Torngat Mountains, all the way to the Brooks Range in Alaska, and we were doing these journeys every summer, which would last sometimes 5 or 6 weeks at a time. And I came back from one of those summer journeys, and I was speaking with Michael Birch, who was at that time the curator of the Art Gallery of Algoma, and we were putting together an exhibition of art based on those journeys. And in our dialogue, Michael said, well, you guys are just like the Group of Seven, traveling throughout the wilderness and painting and photographing and telling your stories. And then Michael said to me in the same breath, do you think you know where any of the Group of Seven might have made some paintings in your travels? And I said, oh, for sure. I think I know where there's a couple spots on the North Shore of Lake Superior. And he says, well, I know for sure they made it. G.H. McDonald made a painting on the Montreal River called The Solemn Land. And he said, would you be interested in doing a few trips and actually looking for some of these painting sites? And I know you guys do books. Would you be interested in maybe working on a book about these painting sites where the Group of Seven traveled throughout Ontario? And I said, yeah, sure. It sounds like a great idea. That's how the effort was born. And our partnership began, and that was 10 years ago now.
And some of the behind the scenes, when you brought together your photography and research and Joni's narratives, can you tell us a little bit about the actual production?
Well, Painted Land was done in reverse because normally you do a book, and film producer, film house sees the book, and they go, man, that would make a great film. And this was sort of in reverse because we didn't do a book. We didn't have a story for anybody to look at. We just had word of mouth, our story, a few photographs telling the stories, and some folks that became friends of ours, the owner of White Pine Pictures, Peter Raymond, and his partner, Nancy Lang, were coming up to Sault Ste. Marie for a fall festival, and they were going to be showing a recent film that they made about Tom Thompson in Algonquin Park. And when we heard they were coming up, Michael and Joni and I said, well, why don't we take these guys up on the Algoma Central Railway and introduce them to a little bit of the research that we've been doing and showing them some Group of Seven painting sites. So they were game for that. About the second day they were here in the Sioux, we caught the Algoma Central Railway and passenger train, and we made our way up to Canyon. And on the way, I actually had a painting called Above the Falls on the Batchewana River that I hadn't actually located before, and I put it up against the train window, and as we went across the trestle over the Batchewana River, I pointed to the painting, and is this the painting? And Nancy and Peter just couldn't believe it. That is a painting. I said, yeah, we just found another Group of Seven painting site on this train ride, and you were with us. Anyways, unbeknownst to us, after that day ended, they had already made a pact that they wanted to make a film with us about our journeys into Group of Seven painting territory and making a documentary film about it. So that's how it began.
Well, it certainly came out to be quite the production and must have had a very good response.
Well, it was interesting because it was filmed over 2 years. The first year was Phyllis Ellis, who was the director, and a friend of mine who was a cinematographer, and Michael and Joy and I headed out with Nancy Lang, and we were just doing a scouting trip along the Algoma Central Railway and the North Shore of Lake Superior. We were showing them locations, and we were basically telling the story of which the documentary film could be made from. And we had great weather, and Phyllis and Nancy were so excited about great days. They couldn't believe what we were showing them. We got right into the filming right away. There was a lot of storytelling, a lot of wandering through the woods, taking them to the painting sites, doing the filming of the painting sites. Dan Neistat did a great job with us that first year. They had almost a film in the bag right there within that 7 days, but then we were going to come back and actually raise the rest of the funds to make the film and come back the second year only with a larger crew, and we were building in a historical component too with live actors. And at one point we were a crew of 19 when we were in Canyon. The second year we had 21 straight days of perfect weather, and we had glorious color that fall. The weather couldn't have been better for us.
And you obviously have a passion for nature's landscapes and gives you a magnificent artistic eye. Can you tell us about your first photographic documentary experience of your journey in the Florida Everglades?
My first photographic experience? Oh, yes. My mom and dad, we planned a trip to visit the Everglades in Florida. So I was six, and that was the first camera that was given to me. And my project was to document that trip into the Everglades. I was learning roll film. It was large format. The camera, I was pretty proud of it. It was just an all-plastic, simple camera. And I created basically black and white pictures, and I made a little photo album from that journey. But it wasn't until, I think, I was about 18 or 19, just graduated from Seneca College, and Joni and I had planned to walk the Appalachian Trail. And my dad gave me a brand new Pentax K1000 camera and 7 rolls of Kodachrome 36 exposure film and said, could you document your journey? So with 7 rolls of film, I think that gave me about 2 or 3 photographs to take per day over a 2,100-mile, 4.5-month hiking trip. So when we came back from that journey, I had this photographic record of our first long-distance journey together. I was able to tell the story of our adventure through a slideshow, and that launched us into writing a few articles about that trip and doing a bunch of presentations about the journey.
With a focus on raising awareness of conservation issues, can you tell us about some of your other projects and how your photography has been a crucial contribution to bringing this awareness to audiences?
Well, definitely photography and writing is our medium. And obviously after Painted Land, filmmaking is another medium to tell the conservation story. 15 years ago, after doing a paddling trip around Lake Superior, we realized the fragility of the basin being the largest expanse of freshwater on the planet. Joy and I created a nature conservancy called the Lake Superior Watershed Conservancy, and it was the first international nature conservancy on Turtle Island. And the idea was to create a not-for-profit so we could actually look for opportunities where there was private land coming up for sale, and we could turn that into conservation lands or turn it back into treaty land for the public to enjoy. So photography is a huge part of telling that story and using it for books or websites or articles. Basically, I think you want to put a term on the type of photography I do. It's called conservation photography.
And can you speak about some of the publications and what's been most rewarding about these works?
Well, so far we've done 8 books, and we are working on a Painted Land book about the Group of Seven. I would say every book is a baby to you. You're proud of all of them, but I guess you might want to look at the first book that we did, which was still in print, still being published by Firefly Books. It's called Where Rivers Run, and it was a story of our 10,000-kilometer paddle from the Gulf of St. Lawrence across Canada to the Beaufort Sea, of which Manitoba was a big part of that because we came down the Winnipeg River into Lake Winnipeg and went up through Loon Straits and paddled up to the Saskatchewan and through Cedar Lake and out to the Paw in Manitoba before we headed up the second year up the Saskatchewan towards the Beaufort Sea. And that book really was an opportunity for us to tell not only an adventure, but actually to raise awareness for a lot of environmental concerns that we had throughout the country. And that book did very, very well for us, but it was our first book. We really had no intention of being published authors, but we got back from that journey, and our publisher said, well, we'd love you to do a photographic book. And we said, well, could we do it about anything? And they said, yes. And we said, well, we'd love to paddle around Lake Superior and write a book about the largest freshwater lake on the planet. And the publisher said, where is Lake Superior, and who would buy this book? And I said, that's what we want to do. And they bought into that. And in a sense, we did that journey knowing that we would actually be able to publish a book at the end of it, like a guarantee from our publisher. That was very important for us to be able to tell that story. And that's really how we created such a close relationship with Lake Superior. And I was proud to say that book was the first book published in North America on totally chlorine-free paper. And Friesens in Manitoba printed that book for us. So I thought they took a big chance. Our publisher thought because it was on totally chlorine-free paper, wouldn't the photographs slide off the page or something like that? And we said, no, I don't think that's going to happen.
Slide off the page.
So that set a standard for Friesens that was their like their top quality photographic production paper. So we were quite happy about that, and that book was a bestseller in Canada and in the United States. And we attracted a great publisher out of the U.S. to go in on the publishing run, which our Canadian publisher was very happy with. And that book still continues to sell and is a great backbone to all our publishing efforts.
Now, it must also be exciting to be able to share your experiences with, you have a daughter who has been with you for many of these adventures. Is she involved in any photographic or written publications at the moment?
Well, she's the game participant, definitely. And when we started the Group of Seven project, she was 10 years old, and it was perfect because I think the closest Group of Seven painting site is about 20 kilometers as the crow flies, right from where we live. So we were able to hop on the Algoma Central Railway and go up to the Batchewana River, go up to the Gooley, the Mishpocotton, and do all these explorations. And then we could get up to the North Shore of Lake Superior, which is only half a day's drive for us, and be out for 2 or 3 weeks at a time paddling on the North Shore between Puckasaw National Park and Rossport, Ontario, in the new National Marine Conservation Area. So she's a great writer. She's in her third year at university at Carleton. She wants to be a lawyer. So the writing is definitely, she's caught up a little bit into the value of good writing. Of course, she has the best iPhone, so she's got a great camera. She probably takes more photographs and film per year than I do, and she certainly knows how to share it. She's got her own little medium that she works with in photography and writing.
What would you advise young artists interested in becoming photojournalists and getting involved in projects such as yours?
I would say it's always good if you've got a passion. I think these days the future is all about communicating climate change and how we go about remedying the climate crisis and telling the story of our ancestors. And I think for young photographers, look at what you're passionate about and then look at how photography can deliver your message. And if you can put words on paper or team up with somebody that likes to write, then you've got a great venue in terms of publishing. I'm an artist photographer. We sell prints, we sell book of photography, but really the books are the medium for our message. And doing books are the backbone to everything we do. Our books tell the story of our lives, right from Where Rivers Run and paddling across Canada right up until our last book about Quetico and working on this book now about the Group of Seven. But the stories also tell, I hope, and I believe they do, and that's why we write them, our stories about how we go about conserving our lands. And I think having a conservation statement that we've always worked towards, and I believe Aldo Leopold wrote this, and it goes, in the end, we will conserve only what we love, we will love only what we understand, and we will understand only what we are taught. And I think our writing and our photography is about that, because people aren't aware of these wild places. They aren't aware of the seriousness of the climate crisis that we're in. We have to wake the world up to what's going on around us. And particularly now, this is our last chance. So I call upon all budding photographers, writers, to take up the challenge because it's going to be up to us.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to share your story and insight with us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you, Susan. It's been a pleasure to share this with your listeners. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest, Vera Bosek, was born in Buffalo, New York, and grew up with her parents of Eastern European heritage in the sprawling suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio, where she explored the densely populated Rocky River watershed and surrounding landscapes with a fascination for natural elements. Vera completed her BFA in sculpture at Louisiana State University and began her practice with a focus on classical realism. She was then accepted into the apprenticeship program at the Johnson Atelier Technical Institute of Sculpture and had her work juried in the annual exhibition at the National Academy of Design and the non-members exhibition at the Salmagundi Club in Manhattan. Moving to Key West, Florida, she discovered the backcountry and zone of the Keys, and here she began her innovative process, such as pulling plaster images off the tidal markings found in the sand produced by the flow of water, documenting movements of the natural elements. Vera has exhibited her work widely in its installations at the Fort Zachary Taylor Historic Park and Key West Garden Club in Florida, to name a few. She has been the executive director of the Sculpture Key West International event in Florida and has been highlighted in Sculpture Magazine's Gallery of Works in their 2014 edition. Good evening, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You have produced an entrancing video that details your working process and how you captured the natural elements of the backcountry of the Florida Keys in your sculpture, Tidal Relief. Can you describe the unique, innovative process behind this remarkable sculpture?
Oh, thank you. Well, it all kind of is process-oriented. I began just pulling plaster forms off of sand when I first got to the Keys, and I found that pulling larger pieces kind of replicated my experience in the awesome backcountry, where you're totally surrounded by the water and the horizon and the colors and nature in general, I guess. So I thought that I really should document my time doing this. As years went on, I thought, well, why don't I just go ahead and do this? And so that was filmed in 2007. But there were other films before that. I had a friend who at the time had a company, and he did advertising, filming, and all of that. So he kind of worked filming me while I was producing. And I thought, well, you know, let me just make my own film the way I want it to be seen, because really only I'm the one that knew what my experience was all about and why I was doing it. And so that is the film that you're talking about.
And can you tell us a bit about that process and how you discovered this technique and what was in that film? Because it was really interesting as far as showing the process.
Well, thank you. Well, I first started the entire process when I left New York City. I was up there for a few years, and I wanted to totally clear my head, because at the time I was doing classical realism, and I really enjoyed it, but then it just was not doing anything for me. I needed to find something else, and I didn't quite know what it was, so I decided to leave New York for a while. I found my way to Key West, where my sister told me I had to check it out, and I really didn't even know where it was. So by the time I got there, I found the backcountry, and I realized that, well, I could be a struggling artist there as I was up in New York, bartending and trying to find my way. So I decided to just really look and search, and I found myself in an isolated sandbar, and I realized I can just start there. I wanted to start from the beginning. I didn't know where that was. I wanted to totally erase everything that I picked up over the years, and I wanted to start over. And I didn't know if that was possible. So when I saw the tidal flow, and I saw how the actual tides were just influencing the sand and the material and particulates of sand on the low-lying areas, I thought, well, let me give this a try. So I started using techniques I picked up over the years, mold making and things, and I picked up my materials, the plaster, the burlap, the conduit, and I started making molds on the found sand formations. And of course, that all had to be timed correctly. I had about 2 hours from low tide to high tide. So I learned a lot through that process. Being from the city, I wasn't really in tune to some of the natural kind of things that happen around there. So I picked up that, okay, you know, I have a couple hours, so let me do what I can do. And I found that I could get as large as something like 5 feet by 6 feet in producing these large plaster reliefs, which I now call tidal reliefs. And so the tidal reliefs themselves have evolved, and they're no longer windows in the world, as I was kind of thinking of it, that windows in something that was unknown to me. They've evolved from just a basic mold to the actual work, to being actual part of the work.
Were any of your ideas informed by earlier or current landscape artists?
Oh, there's so much. Yes, definitely. I picked up so much over the years. And of course, I think with Robert Smithson, with his earthworks, his spiral jetty, of course, that comes to mind. That was really left an impression. And of course, his non-sites and his site. And I loved his mirrored works. That kind of started the conversation, but that wasn't the end, because I was just not really into the destruction of things. I was into the beginning of things. And I think that using Robert Smithson as an example, you have the other earthwork artists like Michael Hauser and all of that. And also, was it Oppenheimer? I forget. But it's just taking the elements of the outside and bringing them inside. To me, that was just really phenomenal. I thought, okay, I can do that. And also, things start evolving as well, because with the images I was taking off the sand, of course, the sand is a positive, the plaster is a negative. Mm-hmm. So you're having various other techniques. The process starts to bring you into other things. And that's what it started to do for me. And I found that I actually was a process artist. I was open to letting things kind of happen and experiment. And I found also eventually that it wasn't just what was found in the sand, it was what was influencing that. I mean, what is going on here? And also, just from the various colors that I would be in contact with and experience and perceive, with the light influencing so many things in the backcountry, that started influencing a lot of my work going forward.
How does your approach change as you do a variety of your installations and sculptures when you work with different materials and other landscapes?
Well, I guess it depends on, maybe it's like in situ, if right. There is an installation going on somewhere that's in an historic structure. I found that being involved with Sculpture Key West, it was really great, because there's 3 red brick structures in Key West itself. And with those, they're just great opportunities for producing various elements, artistic, creative elements within these structures, historically and otherwise. Visually, just astounding. So I started producing that. I guess I was getting into a kind of like a magical realism kind of thing, where, yes, I was getting away from the body, but my body was actually part of the piece, you know, when you think about the tidal reliefs that I was producing. But and with the installations, I would carry the tidal reliefs into these installations, kind of like what Jasper Johns, he would kind of do things and do something else. And that's kind of, again, something I've picked up over the years. Just, I can't help but being influenced by artists who have made it and, you know, are in the media.
Well, it's interesting that you've taken it from the ephemeral, such as Andy Goldsworthy in the UK, and you've been able to capture it into a sculpture and bring it to your audience that way. What do you hope to bring to your viewers' experience with your work?
Well, there's so much. There is so much out there. And I just think the experience of the unknown, and to keep on asking questions. We're in this digital age where so much is happening. And we're not really in tune with the outdoors as much. At least I still need a lot. I need to spend more time outdoors. I would like to connect, and I would like to learn from it somehow, some way. And I find that a lot of it is bringing me toward a like scientific kind of inquiry, where I just love the latest with the space dragon that actually made it just recently. There's a lot of astrophysics, a lot of things going on that it's just amazing that brings part of the world back down to us. So again, there's just so much going on there that it just kind of opens my world up more. And I just hope that for people, for artists who are just starting out, just to keep your mind open and go with your gut feeling.
You've also been involved in the Sculpture Key West initiative. Can you tell us about this organization, how it began, and how it contributes to the artistic community and recognition for many artists?
Well, it began early on, artists by artists. And then it evolved into an actual nonprofit. And it evolved from local artists in Key West to bringing together artists from all over to the United States and also Europe, Australia. It was exciting at the time, but it no longer exists. It had its time. The funding was always difficult to find. I have faith. I think sooner or later it's going to be revived again. I think the last exhibition was in 2013, so it's already 2019. There's a lot going on in Key West, per se, so I still hold out for that, definitely.
What about the Sugarloaf projects, and what kind of works have you designed for that?
Yeah, see, that's something, because I live in this really bizarre area of the Keys where I have to conform. I have to live my life according to the tidal movements. I'm in a spit of land that's off the major road, and sometimes, various times of the year, the water rises, so I have to keep my truck parked on the main boulevard, and I have to walk a quarter mile up to my house, knee-high boots. And doing that, which I really didn't expect that I would be at this point when I started doing my tidal reliefs, you know, way back in the 1990s. So now we're here at 2019, and I realized, okay, I'm at this point, and now this is much more than just what I find on a sandbar. There's a lot going on environmentally. We're dealing in an age right now where we're looking at global warming effects. Who knows how drastic they'll be over the next 10, 20 years. But I feel like I'm kind of in a position to work with that. So it's just another material for me to work with in this property that I have, with the tides going up and down around me in the tidal flats, and with the various plants that find themselves seeded here just from the winds or the birds or whatever. I have this kind of like little mini forest going on of indigenous and invasives. I'm going to manipulate that in a way where it will be another kind of part of my work. And again, it's something where I'm just kind of going forward, not knowing exactly what I'm doing, but I will be using everything I've picked up over the past years and working with this new area. So instead of working with historic landmarks in Key West, I'll be working with this outdoor area. And again, my work has been evolving from the tidal reliefs. Again, they were kind of like something for me to look into, to kind of learn from, and they've been evolving through the installations and through other things that have influenced me. And I'm back into drawing with this type of movement. I've created some movement drawings from my tidal reliefs, and now I'm creating sculptural forms out of the movement drawings, all kind of like becoming something new, something like I'm working with new entities. So it's just kind of crazy stuff, but I'm really enjoying it.
And where do you plan on exhibiting those? Have you got something particular coming up?
Well, I'm involved in an organization called American Abstract Artists. That happened, my involvement in this, I was brought into that organization back in 2006. And a woman artist who I came to know in Key West, she saw my work, and we got to talking, and we got to know each other. And I mentioned to her one time at a gathering, I said, you know, it's really difficult. I would love to get my work out there, but it's just, you know, it's kind of just here in the Keys. And she thought, oh, I have an idea. So she presented me and one of their yearly intakes is what they want to call it for membership. I was brought in. And since 2006, I've been in some really incredible exhibitions, and I'm really involved with a lot of incredible artists. And I love that the focus is abstraction, of course. This organization began in 1936, and it's continuing on with this whole focus of immediacy and light and purity. And so it really all fit into with my work. A lot has been going on. Trying to post my resume online, there's a lot of other things I want to do. So maybe eventually you'll see what I've been involved in. But up currently, just this past year, there's two exhibitions that are really interesting to me and I'm very happy to be part of. One is called Blurring Boundaries. It was put together by the University of Tennessee, and it is the Women of American Abstract Artists from 1936 to the present. And the team that put that together, Sam Yates is the director and curator of this, and his assistant, Sarah Falls, they've been fantastic in pulling this all together, and it'll be traveling in the next few years. You'll be able to see it, I believe, it's on a website, International Art and Artists. It's artsandartists.org. You'll see that it's listed there, and beginning in 2020 or so, it's going to start exhibiting are 2022, something like that.
Does it travel to Canada at all?
You know, it could. I mean, because this is through the International Art and Artists. I know they even exhibit in Europe. So it would be really great to get that in Canada.
Yeah, it would.
Definitely.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your innovative works and advice with us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I wish you continued success in your upcoming exhibitions.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.